comes way at night. Many a moon coming, shine a light.
Welcome to Paris Cocktail Talk. I'm 52 Martinis, and I'm here to tell you what, where, why, and how to drink in the capital, with a focus on French trends and ingredients. This week, we're going to talk a bit about Paris Cocktail Week, which just finished up. We had 40 bars and 10 restaurants that were putting out drink specials across town, so about 100 cocktails, 50 non-alcoholic cocktails that were available at very nice prices. There were master classes, special events, and interesting guest bartender stints. I don't really want to do a lengthy recap on what happened, but instead, we'll talk to some of the industry that was involved in Paris Cocktail Week, and we'll talk to them about what happened during the week, as well as the current state of cocktails and other interesting tidbits. I'll be speaking with Christina Monaco, the brand ambassador for Schweppes Premium Mixers and a bartending and spirits consultant. I will also grab a drink with Joseph Boley of Red House to chit-chat about the current state of cocktails. And I'll ask master chocolate maker and pastry chef Jacques Jenna about the similarities between being a chef and being a mixologist. So whether or not you participated in Paris Cocktail Week, you should be able to find something interesting in this week's interviews. So I'm here down at the Lone Palm now, and I'm with Christina Monaco, who's the ambassador for Schweppes Premium Mixers. And I feel very fortunate to have a little moment to sit down and talk to her about what's going on with Paris Cocktails Week and what's going on the cocktail scene here now. So thank you, Christina, for taking the time to meet me for a drink.
Thanks for having me.
So I ask everybody from the beginning, can you sum up what you think about the Paris cocktail scene in three words?
So I think it's, I can say fantastic, eclectic. Can you say eclectic?
Yeah.
Eclectic. And also, I couldn't find another one. Maybe fantastic, eclectic. And, I couldn't find that word in English. But you know when people are bind together?
Mm-hmm.
It's like cohesion?
Yeah, cohesion.
Yes,
yeah.
Cohesion.
Yes. Great. Great. So, what bars have you gotten out to for Paris Cocktail Week, and what have you been thinking about it?
So, my favorite bar from the cocktail week, or favorite cocktail? Or
just said, what have you gotten out and done, and yeah, what was your favorite?
Oh, my favorite place is definitely Le Calba.
Yeah, I was just there before seeing Joe, so.
For the atmosphere, and also the cocktail. And yeah. I was really surprised by some kind of small bar that we never heard of. Like, I think about the bar of the restaurant Beaucoup.
Yeah.
It's the same owner as the place we went to from the masterclass gin and tonic at Grand Coeur. And they made that really amazing mocktail with a juniper water and a Schweppes Premium mixer and a fruit. So it's a lot of research behind, and I've been really surprised by that kind of place in Paris that I never heard of before.
Yeah, I agree. It's always nice to find like a new discovery, something that you... Yeah, because we all talk about and know a lot about the same bars, but it's nice to find a new discovery. So, why do you think Paris Cocktail Week needs a gin tonic masterclass? Oh, I actually should say for the listeners that Christina presented a gin and tonic masterclass during Paris Cocktail Week. So, now, please tell us why.
So I think in Paris, large consumer, not talking about bartender or people of the industry, needs a bit of update about gin and tonic. Regarding the gin and tonic in the 19th, for example, when you just had a tumbler with a regular gin and one kind of tonic. And now we have that whole range of gin available on the market. Also a whole range of tonic, not only Indian tonic, but you've got different flavors, and so it's just to get people to know what we have on the market and what kind of drink you can do with those new products, and that a gin tonic is not just a simple drink, just a simple long drink. It could be a really amazing drink if you find the right tonic and also the right gin and behind nice citrus, botanicals. You can have a really nice moment behind just a gin and tonic after.
I agree. I know a lot of people who have spent a lot of time trying to perfect their gin and tonic, so it's not just a little gin and a little tonic in a glass.
It's not really complicated. We try to make it complicated now, but it's just to find the right flavors if you find the perfect gin and the perfect tonic, you can have a really, really amazing moment just behind a simple beverage. It's just a simple, it's not a cocktail, it's just a simple long drink.
Yeah.
So it's just to get to know people that is different from the 90s, and in 2016 now you can have an amazing gin and tonic if you make just a little bit of research or a good masterclass.
Very good. Now, I don't expect you to repeat the entire masterclass for the listeners, but can you just give us a little bit of history about tonic and about gin and tonics? And there was a few things that you said that I really enjoyed in the masterclass, so maybe just a little quick summary on G&Ts and the beginning of tonic.
So the beginning of tonic, it all began with the British soldiers. They drank that trend of gin and tonic. But first of all, it was in Peru. It was in Peru. There was the contest of Sintra, and she got healed and she was cured by Indian, the Quechua Indian, with a kind of bark that no one known from a tree that was called the fever tree. And then they took that small bark, which is quinine, and they cured that lady with the bark. So it became kind of a healing beverage. And in the 17th century, when the British soldiers were in India, they had a ration of tonic, and it was to cure malaria, or what we call scorbut in French. And then they add just a small amount of citrus, of water, and of course they had every day a daily ration of gin, and just how we say a spoonful of sugar in the song of Mary Poppins. It was just to help the medicine go down, and that's how the gin and tonic, not the fizzy one, began.
So something that I've been curious about and asked a few people about is, we are really close to a lot of countries that are kind of obsessed with gin tonics. Spain, the UK. So why do you think French people have not really like grabbed on to gin and tonics?
Well, first of all, we are really patriotic people here. So we like our cognac, we like Armagnac, we've got a lot of wine, we also have that champagne culture, we've got lots of liqueurs, and I just think that French people doesn't have time for gin or gin and tonic. It's just, we have another culture. In England, for example, it is the gin culture since a long, long time. In Spain also, they are the biggest consumers of gin and tonic in the world. But in France, it's just, we simply just haven't discovered all the range of spirits, liqueurs, wine and champagne we have here, so we don't have time for gin or gin culture or gin tonic. Maybe in 100 years it will change, but for the moment I think French people, the large consumer, doesn't have time.
Ah, that was one of my questions. So do you think we will ever replace the mojito with the gin and tonic for this the most frequently ordered cocktail in Paris?
No.
Okay. Ah, all right.
No, it's also the cocktail that all people in France order. I come from south of France, and it's mojito, mojito, mojito. Maybe the caipirinha will come after it, but never gin and tonic.
All right. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, so with the cocktail craze, you know, we have all of these artisanal tonics right now, or all of these specially made tonics. So how is kind of Schweppes placing themselves in that? I'm assuming they're sort of putting their foot in the door there with the premium mixers. Is there more that you want to say about that?
Well, it's just the answer for consumers. Regarding the whole market of gin, now, for example, you can have bars with 200 different gins, so you need to provide an answer to this with different tonics. The difference, for example, with the Schweppes Premium Mixer is the bubbles inside will stay in the glass for... we've made some kind of test experience. If you keep your glass for about 30, 45 minutes, a gin and tonic, you will keep all the bubbles. That's why you you enjoy a real gin and tonic, that you have that bubbles inside. And also in the premium mixer we have less sugar than in a regular in gin tonic, for example. Mm-hmm. And we have different flavors because you have the kind of choice, the gin and tonic, the normal in gin tonic. But if you go for yourself for a gin that is more peppery or that is more on herbs or on citrus, we would like to provide an answer to this with some different flavors. That's why in France you can find the pink pepper, mm-hmm. and also the ginger and cardamom. In other countries you have lavender and orange blossom. And also, yeah, you have...
I don't think I realized there was different premium mixers in different countries. I think that's interesting.
Yes, yes. Okay. On the market in Spain also you have hibiscus tonic. Okay. So it's about 8 or 9 flavors, different flavors, but it depends on the market. Okay. In France, we will start with 3 different, just to start, and after, I think we will have some other flavors.
Okay. I find that this year, for the Paris Cocktail Week, there's been a really big focus on the non-alcoholic cocktails, on mocktails. Do you have, like, a favorite way that you use tonic in a non-alcoholic drink?
It depends, first of all, the kind of tonic you're using, but I think that it needs to be the whole beverage with tonic, not just like we use an cocktail with alcohol in it by topping. It's just use the whole tonic, kind of citrus. If you're using the ginger and cardamom, for example, use botanicals. You can use rosemary or ginger or cardamom. And also, if you're using the pink pepper, you can use some citrus. You can make a lot of combination while making mocktails.
Right.
So, but I will get some advice to take the whole bottle, pour it on ice, and just maybe the perfect way for me to drink it. Just add a few citrus, citrus peels, and maybe 1 or 2 flower. Yeah. And enjoy it just that way.
You probably don't want to say, because I'm sure they're all good, but do you have a favorite flavor in the premium mixer range?
I really enjoy the ginger and cardamom.
Yeah, I liked that one too.
Yeah, I think it's just my taste, my palate. Really enjoyed that one. And here at the Lone Pine, I had the non-alcoholic cocktail before you arrived, and it was made with the tonic, ginger, and cardamom. And I think it was the perfect match. And for example, they've been using pineapple cordial in it. And it was really, really, really good cocktail. I really enjoyed it.
Nice.
And the ginger and cardamom, yes. It's my favorite one. I'm English, so I really enjoyed ginger.
Ginger's good. I like it. Adds a little spice. Well, I usually wrap up every interview by asking, what is your favorite cocktail? So do you want to share with us your favorite cocktail?
Yes, of course. So my favorite cocktail is The Last Word.
Oh, it's such a good one, right?
Yes, yes. For me, it's the perfect balance, the perfect combination. And I used to train bartender in my job. And when they asked me for what can be the perfect combination of a cocktail, and The Last Word, for me, equal parts, is just the perfect balance. I'm a really good fan of chartreuse.
Yeah.
I love gin. I love that freshness of the drink. And I can spend a whole night with The Last Word, but with a responsible drinking, of course.
Of course. We all want to drink responsibly, but I totally agree. I think The Last Word has an amazing balance. I think, you know, kudos to Murray for rediscovering that.
Yeah.
And I also think it's a really good cocktail to introduce people who don't really drink a lot of cocktails, to introduce them to what is really interesting about cocktails. It's really nice sense of balance.
Yeah, how to do the balance of sugar and citrus, spices and herbs, and also with the main spirit. You can find all the flavors of what you're adding in your drink in that cocktail.
I also think it is nice that it's an equal parts cocktail, because it's very easy to remember when I'm at home making drinks for people.
Yes,
equal parts,
yes,
so I don't have to worry about it. So it's nice. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I'm sorry, I was running late. I admit it to every listener, I was running late. It's my pet peeve, so thank you for talking to me, and thank you for bearing with my lateness.
We'll
blame that on Joe.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, and cheers.
Run with the wolves, girl, I'm never lost. Run with the wolves, girl, I'm never lost.
So I'm at the
the bar, the Medusa, and I just made a quick cheeky stop at the Cal Bar, which, if you listeners haven't heard of it, it's the bar where the boys tend bar in their boxers, and not in a cheesy Chippendales way, but like in a really cute, fun way. So now I'm hanging out here with my friend Joe, and we're going to chat with him a little bit about Paris Cocktail Week and his thoughts on the Paris cocktail scene. Joseph Bowie is the man behind the Red House. The Red House is a bar near Bastille. It's a bar where Joe, Jen, the team, they make some great cocktails. You can also get shots. You can get beer on tap. But I think they've got some bottles of red and white in the back there. So there's a pinball machine. There's Longhorns behind the bar. It's just a really fun, lively space. And they are also part of Paris Cocktail Week. So I feel very fortunate that Joe took a moment to stop and have a drink with me so we can chat with him a little bit. Thanks, Joe. Always good to have a drink with you. As you know, I'm starting out my interviews with the same question for everybody. Can you sum up the cocktail scene here in 3 words?
So I got the questions earlier, and I've actually been trying to think about this and make something concise. I think the main word I came up with was diverse, which is, I think, a new thing for Paris, that there's, you know, with the second Paris Cocktail Week, the tons of new bars that have opened and different styled bars, and that it's finally diverse enough, I think, to appeal to lots of different people. You know, instead of what happened in most cities, London or New York, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, with speakeasies and then a certain type of atmosphere and everything. Now you just, it's like this place, Medusa, you know, it's a rock and roll bar. It's, the last thing they want to pretend to be is a cocktail bar, but they make really good cocktails and they're really accessible.
Yeah. I think that's going to be the future, the saving grace, actually, of Paris cocktail bars, is that they are diversifying now. Like, we can't have 100 speakeasies, we can't support it. So, I agree, and I think that's very good.
There's nothing against speakeasies.
No.
At all. It's just, I think each bar has, like, its own, you know, definitely its own thing that it puts forward, and it appeals to certain people, and there are certain moments to enjoy that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And different moments to enjoy different types of things. And now we just have a lot of choices.
It's a good thing. And how is Paris Cocktail Week going for you?
Really well. I think where I really saw the difference was at the beginning of the week, where we're normally pretty quiet, just our sort of regular after-work crowd. And really, like, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we had a real big boost beginning of the night. Like, people showing up at 6 o'clock with these maps in their hands, you know, and like really like, what's your drink? What's this? You know, like really curious people and really, like a lot of people this week have come to the bar and been like, oh wow, I've never been here before. And I'm like, oh, do you live in the neighborhood? And they're like, no, I live in the 14th on the other side of Paris. And I'm like,
right,
great.
Yeah.
You know, perfect.
So this year there's been a lot on the mocktails. What do you think about that? Any opinions?
I understand the politics behind it. Not like cutthroat politics or anything like that, but just, you know, another step in making the bar more available to more and more people. And I think that needs to be respected, and like anything else we do, like designing new menus or doing mocktails or, you know, trying to do a food pairing, it's pushing us into new directions.
Maybe you've talked about this already a little bit with the diversity, but what do you think is the most interesting thing happening in the Paris cocktail scene right now?
Sometimes I have the feeling that I'm a goldfish in his fishbowl, trying to look out and discern the world around me, because I can't, you know, I'm working a lot, I'm in my own bar, and then my own neighborhood, and then this city, and it's really hard to see what's going on with the customer base over at some of the bars that have been there for a long time already, like Experimental or Candelaria, and then a lot of the newer places like the Tiger. And
what if we take it to like a micro level? What about what's happening right here around Bastille?
Well, most of my nights off, I actually just stay in the neighborhood now. There's enough bars that are really my style of bars. You know, good rock and roll. None of the places serve expensive drinks. You know, it's mainly between here, Red House, and Lone Palm, where I'm at all the time.
So, you know, the next question is going to be, is there something that you think is really overrated in the Paris cocktail scene?
I think that's it might be a bit more difficult to perceive. I think on an international level, there's a lot of really good bartenders here, and there have been a lot of Paris-specific trends, like using French spirits or promoting French heritage around spirits. I still believe, in general, between, I would say, like New York, London, and Paris, I feel in general that the cocktail bars sort of have the best palate in Paris, which I don't know if that's just because I live here, so we all share the same palate, but I find that drinks are consistently well balanced here compared to other cities.
Yeah.
I think between Mabel, Candelaria, Little Red Door, Dirty Dick, Lulu White, the Syndica, Lone Palm, I think all of these places, I think there's a very unique French palate in its definition of what makes a balanced cocktail.
I just feel like everybody is always talking about Paris, it's great, and it's kind of, you know, a curtain darling because everybody is like loving the fact that we're focusing on French ingredients, which I think is very important. But I also personally think that could get a little overrated sometimes because I feel ingredients have always been a cornerstone of
cocktails. It always happens when you get like a new girlfriend.
Right.
You know, and then you gotta go through a couple of weeks of dirty socks and things start
super
to sit
awesome
in.
Yeah, and then there's the dirty laundry. Yeah. That's what I think. I think we've got some room still to work with French ingredients because I do think people have been working French ingredients for a long time elsewhere, but I think that they're going to be working them in a really interesting way here because it is close to home. So you've been working, how long have you been working in bars? I know you were at Bottle Shop 15 years. You were at Bottle Shop before Red House. Were you someplace before that?
I worked in a Basque when I moved here.
Okay.
And then I worked in like bar cafes in the States.
So you've been in the scene, and you've been in the scene since before, what we're going to say, 7 or 8 years ago, which is when, you know, before ECC and after ECC, right? So, I don't know. Is there anything that you want to talk about? You think about, like, the difference between, like, what was happening then and now what's happening with, you know, craft cocktails everywhere?
Well, it's a funny cycle because, you know, I wasn't involved with cocktails at all when ECC opened. But there's been a funny cycle, and I'm sure other cities have gone through this too, where, you know, it's sort of like finally somebody, and I've heard you say this, like finally somebody opens a real cocktail bar and knows what they're doing. And then, you know, there was a couple of places opened up, and it was, you know, it was real small. And then that, in some way, it became very authoritative and exclusive. And it became too exclusive to my liking. And then it became less exclusive, and now there's way more places, and we get back to that diversity and different styles and, you know, hotel bars, dive bars. The general knowledge of good service, which includes making good drinks, is getting spread throughout the city slowly but surely.
You know, I feel like Red House was one of the kind of the first places that, for me, fortunately kicked off this idea that we don't have to be this speakeasy, typical what we imagine as this new craft cocktail bar thing. So it's kind of like one of the first places that work towards this democratization of cocktails. I don't necessarily think that was, like, you weren't going in saying, oh, I'm going to be, you know, a silent forerunner on the democratization of cocktails, but I like that.
Well, it was kind of.
Well, good. Okay, I mean, tell me about it.
I don't want to brag too much about, you know, almost 5 years ago when I opened Red House, because I didn't really know what I was doing. I was very curious, though, and had a few cocktail books back then. And, you know, it's reading Gary Reagan's Joy of Mixology and trying to learn how to properly make a Sazerac. But there was so many things that I had no idea about what I was doing. But I did believe that I could offer good things to normal people, people that would never go to a speakeasy or to a, you know, to a palace hotel bar, and that they could discover this, and they actually have. You know, it's been almost 5 years, and okay, I'll give you, this happened yesterday. I met a guy that works in London yesterday for lunch. And he said he had a new waitress working there who was of Danish origin, and that she had spent a little bit of time in Paris. And so at the end of the shift, they're like, would you like a cocktail with the rest of the staff? And she's like, I don't really know anything about cocktails. And they were like, well, what do you usually drink? She's like, the only cocktail I've ever really liked was the Red House Old Fashioned.
I love it. Okay.
And so the bartenders were going around trying to figure out what that was until they finally pieced together that it was this bar in Paris. And so, you know, that's awesome.
Maybe you vaguely remember when I came into the bottle shop for the blog, and I was really interested and impressed and intrigued by the fact that you said you added bitters to your martinis.
Pink gin.
Yeah, exactly. But I never, you know, like I never go into any bar and say I'll have a martini and they suggest bitters. Now at home, I always put, you know, orange bitters in my martinis. So were you like reading cocktail books back at the time when you were at Bottle Shop?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
It was, I mean, I think one man can only make so many mojitos.
Right.
I started there 10 years ago. I'm 36 now. And, you know, that was a young man's job. It's not a middle-aged man's job. And I had to find a way to carry that through and to continue to be able to bartend. Also, you know, I did it back then on my own terms for a 27-year-old young man. And that evolved into thinking about the future, finally opening a bar, trying to do something different, but something that also coincided with my own personality, my own interests as somebody getting older. And, you know, I just started reading. My first cocktail book was The Joy of Mixology, you know. My second one, Dale DeGroff. And it's still the first book that I give a new person that we're training.
I think we all should start with those kind of books.
It's like,
yeah.
You know, then you start learning about shrubs and this and that. And it all just, I think for somebody who's curious, it just comes naturally. And then, you know, if you practice enough, it becomes easier to share that with people and to get them curious about it, which is the whole point of Cocktail Week, too.
Yeah, which is absolutely. Do you think there's any like trends we'll be seeing in 2016? Anything you've been seeing a little bit more of?
Good trends that we're going to see is a lot better beer selections. I think places like this, Medusa and Red House and Lone Palm again, like it's kind of my little neighborhood triangle. I think they'll continue to expand. You know, that places like that will happen. I think also, you know, there's only been a couple of key neighborhoods, which has pretty much been the Maui and Pigalle.
Right.
And I think that's gonna vanish. You know, I think those neighborhoods will still be there, but it won't just be two poles.
Right.
you know, there's going to be stuff popping up all over the place.
I really love the fact that new bars were popping up, you know, in 2007, a few here and there, but they were already kind of in the same wheelhouse. And I think that now, maybe, hopefully, I don't know, Parisians, locals, will expect good drinks no matter where they go, whether it's in a restaurant or where they're going for brunch. I want a you know, decent Bloody Mary, a decent like brunch cocktail.
Oh my god.
Yeah. I know.
I would kill for a good Bloody Mary.
Do you have a favorite place?
Make a really good bloody here.
All right.
But they only open at 6.
Oh, well.
I have a thing about bloodies after dark.
I'm okay with that, but you know, brunch bloodies. We need some good brunch bloodies.
Open all day? It's tough.
Yeah.
Bottle shop, I guess.
Yeah.
Open at 11, you know.
All right, we'll wrap it up. So, what's your favorite cocktail?
You really need to ask that
I don't,
question.
But the listeners need to know.
Well, my favorite cocktail was my favorite cocktail a very long time ago. And while we were building the bar, we would ask Bottle Shop, where I used to work, which is about a block away, to send us over pictures of this cocktail because we were working like 17-hour days. And so to honor that, my favorite love of this cocktail, and just that, you know, it's like we built this city on rock and roll.
Yeah.
We built that bar on Negronis.
Yeah.
Because we love you.
For listeners who don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've always got a 5-euro Negroni in the bar.
Still do.
So, yeah. So get yourselves down to the Red House. Go have a 5-euro Negroni. Say hi to Joe. And, yeah, probably meet some cool people at the bar because it's a real neighborhood, fun, kickback, local vibe. Thanks, Joe.
So during Paris Cocktail Week, I had the chance to attend one of the events, which was the Combat des Chefs at one of the two Jacques Genin shops in town. At this event, there was two challengers. One was the world-famous chocolate maker and pastry chef Jacques Genin, and the other was Maxime Potvert of the Experimental Cocktail Club. Each challenged the other one to come up with something using a specific set of ingredients, and thus we had both a dessert and a cocktail that included, among other things, capers, chocolate, and hazelnut paste. The results were interesting and enlightening, and it was really fun to watch these two working together, but coming from their own separate worlds and backgrounds. I had a chance to catch up and interview Jacques following the event, and I have long been a fan of his creations, especially his caramels. And for those who haven't had the opportunity to meet him, he's friendly, he's fun, and he's funny. When I first became aware of Jacques Genin and his products, it was years ago, before he had the shops, and he was working out of a workshop in the 15th, and then he sold his creations to high-end restaurants and the like, rather than the general public. But I had heard back then, if you stop by and you knock on the door at this unmarked address and you ask really nicely, you might be able to come in and sample some sweets and even buy a box in bulk. So I did. Feeling a little weird, I knocked on this door at this random place, asking the random strangers behind it to let me in and feed me good things that weren't really available for general public consumption. They did. I tasted. I was amazed. The caramels are absolutely mind-blowing. And I also bought a very large box, which didn't last very long. But the whole point of this story is to really bring up what I think is kind of an interesting connection between Genin and the cocktail world. The whole operation really felt like a speakeasy, having to know about the place, daring to knock, and then slip inside. So that's just a bit of a fun side fact. And now, years later, he's got his two lovely shop fronts, and we will get back to the interview. He declined to do the interview in English, and who am I to argue with him? So we chatted a bit in French, and I'll try my best to summarize it.
Il y a souvent les gens qui disent qu'il y a ces liens entre les chefs et les mixologistes. Moi, je ne suis pas tout à fait d'accord, mais je pense que si c'est plutôt avec les chefs de pâtisserie qui vraiment peuvent faire des comparaisons. Est-ce que vous avez des pensées sur ça ou est-ce que vous trouvez qu'il y a vraiment des choses qui sont un peu pareilles entre le chef de pâtisserie et les mixologistes?
En fait, moi, je trouve que c'est la même chose, c'est le même métier. C'est le même métier, pourquoi ? Parce que tous ces métiers-là travaillent sur les mêmes origines, le produit.
On the comparisons between chefs and mixologists that we so often hear,
Jacques feels like they really are all working from the same place. They're all working with consumable products. So whether it's a chef, a pastry chef, a fishmonger, a butcher, or a mixologist, they're all coming from the same place. Now, this was not the first time I'd seen Jacques mixing the sweet and the hard stuff up. For example, I've seen him as a regular fixture at Whiskey Live with his chocolates. So I asked him about his interest in mixing chocolates with spirits. And he affirmed that, first of all, he really enjoys a good drink. Don't we all? And that after having discovered the range of products and whiskies at places like La Maison du Whisky and having had the opportunity to work with various people in the cocktail and spirits industry, that it just really opened up further ideas on how to pair his products with spirits and how to further work with them. I asked him about his favorite chocolate and whiskey pairing, and he was very enthusiastic about the Nika Takesuru 21 with a caramelized macadamia chocolate. I also asked him if he has any future projects that combine chocolates or sweets with spirits, and he doesn't seem to for the moment, or if he does, he wasn't sharing them with me. He told me that he was just going to let the future take him where it takes him for the moment. And his favorite dessert is tarte tatin, and his favorite cocktail is a whiskey sour. So once again, I'd like to thank Mr. Jacques Genin for taking the time to speak with me after the event, and I will put links to his shops and information in the show notes. And that's a wrap for this week. Thanks to Christina Monica of My Own Company and Schweppes Premium Mixers. Thanks to Jacques Genin of the Eponymous Shop. And thanks to Joseph Bowley of Red House. I'll put links to their places and projects in the show notes so you can check them out later. As always, a big thanks to Sam Little for the use of his amazing song The River as our show music. And special thanks to Emily Dilling, who edits and produces the podcast. If you're looking for more Cocktail Talk in between episodes, don't forget to check out the blog, www.52martinis.com. And we really want to cover things that you find interesting. So in our show notes, we're going to put a little place where you can send in questions or ideas for future episodes. And until then, cheers!